Today, how billions of dollars of Russian money made its way into Europe via a network of tax haven firms. And in opinion, memories of the Prodigy's lead singer, Keith Flint. So you've been kind of living and breathing all of this. You must be kind of seeing dollar signs in your sleep at the moment.
Yes, it's a big sprawling mess of data. We've seen about 1.3 million files, and it's thought to be one of the largest ever leaks of banking data.
What did you think when you first came across this leak? Because you've worked a lot on, you were at the forefront of the Panama Papers investigation. When you saw this, What did you think?
Oh God, not another one. I'm going to be stuck here for months.
The Guardian's Juliette Garside regularly reports on big money and corruption. She's won awards for her investigations into the Panama Papers and the HSBC files. And now she's turned her attention to something called the Troika Laundromat in one of the biggest banking leaks ever. You say, oh no, not again, but there must have been something in you that was a bit kind of excited at who might lie at the end of this trail.
Yes. Well, I'm really interested in where the money ends up, because so much of it ends up here in the UK. And the UK is so very reluctant to clamp down on this flow of money or prosecute any institution which handles it knowingly.
Juliette has been digging into a network of shell companies. Companies that appear to be set up for the sole purpose of moving money from Russia into Europe. The network is called a laundromat because it works like a washing machine. All sorts of money goes in, some of it dirty, but all of it comes out looking clean.
Yes, you can think of it like a glass of water. So clear water, if you release a drop of ink into it, you'll see the ink at first, but eventually it gets diluted and mixed in with the water and eventually dissolves to the point where it's invisible. And I think that's similar to what is going on here. So as the money goes through the different shell companies, we can see that some of the money going in is criminal or potentially criminal, but it's actually really impossible to separate that from the rest of the money, the legitimate money.
The Troika laundromat is complicated, but bear with us. Because the network takes us to private jets and private schools, Putin's best friend, and not one, but two princes. From The Guardian, I'm India Rakerson. Today in Focus, inside the money machine that moved billions from Russia to Europe. So, Juliette, you and other investigative journalists around the world have been working on this huge investigation, which has finally now been published, and you're calling it the Troika Laundromat. What is the Troika Laundromat?
Well, the Troika Laundromat was basically a huge financial operation, a money-moving machine. They helped move billions of dollars of private wealth out of Russia and into Europe. And it's called the Troika Laundromat because it was being run by an independent arm of Troika Dialogue, which was a Russian investment bank. But the leak was wider than that. We actually saw 1.3 million transactions involving over 230,000 account holders. Most of these were shell companies. The leak comes from different Baltic banks, mainly a bank called UKIO in Lithuania. The Troika laundromat was about 70 offshore companies. But what we've also seen amongst all this other information is a series of other mini laundromats.
Okay, how much money are we talking about flowing through from Russia into Europe? And where does it come from? Is it all just individuals' personal wealth?
We think most of the money comes from personal wealth. These are wealthy business people and their families. But some of it seems to come from Russian frauds. In total, we're talking about $4.6 billion coming into Europe. A lot of the $4.6 billion is probably money that was legitimately earned. But through very careful tracing, it also seems that some of this cash comes directly from shell companies used to launder the proceeds of crime. And we've traced three specific, very high-profile fraud cases. And the victims of these frauds were the ordinary Russian taxpayers. The thing is, When the money comes out at the other side in Europe, you can't say for sure whether the bit of money that's being spent on a yacht or private school fees or whatever has come from frauds or from completely legitimate sources. That's because it's all being mixed together. And because it's being mixed together, all these service providers in England and Spain and wherever at the other end, they don't know whether there's dark money in there. They have no reason to suspect that anything is wrong. And what we're being told by the private clients of Troika is that they had no idea about the other money flowing through this network either. The money moves around in a convoluted way. It's vague and it's confusing, and probably deliberately so.
What do we know about who was running Troika at the time this was happening?
So we know that the chairman of the board of Troika at the time was an Armenian called Ruben Vardanyan, and he had a big stake in the bank. They were one of the pioneering investment banks in Russia.
To get more and more connections with people from different countries, more and more opportunity to study together, to exchange ideas, to exchange views, I think will help Russia.
And they were seen as very Western friendly. And Ruben Vardanyan, as far as he is known in the financial world, is seen as very much the acceptable face of Russian capitalism.
What's he like?
I guess he looks like your sort of friendly uncle. You know, he's a bit Father Christmas like. He's a big man with a big belly, and he's open. He's chatty. He's got a big house here in London, sent his children to school here. He's from Armenia and he likes to hang out in Davos.
Bit of a philanthropist as well.
Co-founder and chair of the IDEA Foundation, Ruben Vardanyan.
Yes, he co-founded the Aurora Prize, which is a prize for humanitarian work.
Oscar-winning movie star, George Clooney.
And in fact, he persuaded George Clooney, the Hollywood actor, to come to Armenia to give out the prize.
I wanted to give a toast to Ruben. And honestly, if we were giving out awards in some way or another, we would probably be giving them to you, and that's the truth.
How much did Ruben Vardanyan, as the controlling shareholder of Troika, know about what the bank was doing, running this network to move money into Europe?
Well, he says the network was an independent arm of his main investment bank, and that he was never involved in its operation or management, and that he had no day-to-day interaction with its activities. But ultimately, he was the boss. He was a controlling shareholder of Troika. So I think it's perfectly fair to ask questions about how light touch the regulation of the of this independent network was under his leadership. Anyway, his response to us was that their compliance procedures met all the requirements of the legislation at the time.
So the basic idea of the laundromat is to move money, some of it criminal, some of it not, like you said, from Russia to Europe, where it can be spent without questions being asked, essentially. So how does it work? Let's try and just follow the money a bit. What's the first step?
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to get the money out of Russia. So staff at Troika operated a series of 70 shell companies. And what they would do is they would run the money into these shell companies and then between them through a maze-like series of exchanges so that the money would become anonymous and mixed together. There's a big effort to disguise who really owns and controls these companies. And the way they do it is they use proxies, nominees, people who've sold their signatures or given their signatures to the bank and whose signatures are stamped on the documents. But what we see in the data is that it's Troika staff managing these companies, not the people whose names appear as the owners.
Right, so these people have absolutely nothing to do with the network at all, but their signatures are being used to move money from one shell company to the other. Did you manage to track any of these people down?
We did. We've got some brilliant Armenian reporters and Russian reporters who've managed to track them down and interview them.
Who? What sort of people?
They're not rich. And this is where I think this really sticks in the throat. So these are people signing off on deals that might be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. One of them is a cleaning lady. Two of them are seasonal construction workers. Another lives with his parents in a flat. When he was visited, they didn't even have the heating on. One chap was shown a contract with his signature on it in which $40 million changed hands. And he said, "That's my signature, but I've never seen this contract must have been faked. I think some of them were aware, but one thing you can be sure of, these are not the people who controlled the companies. Troika staff controlled the companies, and we know that because they are the ones who gave their contact details, their emails and the phone numbers to the bank that was moving the money for these companies. And when the bank needed instructions, it went to Troika. It didn't go to the people whose signatures appear. It didn't go to the cleaning lady in Moscow.
So you have these shell companies and money's moving into them. How does it then get into the EU? What's the next step?
Pocket banks, banks that are willing to not ask too many questions that are based in Europe. And in this case, the pocket bank was the Lithuanian bank UKIO, which is where we got a lot of the leaked data for this investigation from. Once it's in an EU bank, a bank that has a license to operate inside the European Union, it can then go on to other banks like HSBC or Coutts, and it does, without too many questions.
So UK is that kind of point where it's like, it's almost the money can kind of relax and now it can just get into the system.
It's in the system, that's okay. It's breached the wall around Europe that's meant to protect us from accepting laundered funds.
So once it's passed through the Lithuanian bank, through UKIO, what's the final step? Where does it end up?
In some cases, we can see payments directly out of Lithuania to the service provider. So it could be a firm of interior designers in London. It could be Rolls-Royce Motors in London. It could be Coutts Bank in London. It could be the purchase of land to build a holiday home in Spain, paying for the crewing and maintenance of private jets.
So just spending wealth.
Spending wealth.
Big.
Flashy, big spending.
Wealth.
Bling spending.
What's the most bling thing you've seen?
One of Mr. Vardanian's associates and co-shareholders in Troika loved yachts, and we've seen 70 million in payments for his yachts. He appears to have bought and maintained two yachts with this money. One was called the Celestial Hope, and one was the Quinta Essentia.
There's actually this kind of amazing video online of the yacht, of the Quintessentia. It gives you a virtual tour of it. And it is unbelievably flashy.
Good morning, Quintessentia. This is your captain speaking. It's going to be another beautiful day.
I think they spent $60,000 installing like a hammam type sauna, another 15 grand on water toys.
Water toys. They like, I really want to know what they are.
That's like a floating seahorse. A very golden Lilo.
Just one of those foam tubes, but a really good one.
A really good one. In fact, the ship itself, the daughter was interviewed describing how each room is scented with a perfume made from wine from their Italian vineyard. And we can also see the payments to purchase and maintain that going through the laundromat.
They had their own perfume for their yacht rooms from their vineyard.
From their vineyard.
We talked about Ruben Vardanian at the beginning. He's the philanthropist and also the controlling shareholder of Troika. Was he using this network or companies within this network for personal spending?
He was using this network to cover his private expenses. We can see money to his mother-in-law in Spain. But it's really weird because the purpose of the transactions is recorded in the bank's books as contracts and loans.
For his mother-in-law.
For his mother-in-law. It seems like a very official sort of relationship. Vardanian also had a very big party for his staff in 2007. And he hired the rock star Prince to come and play. And we can see the transactions, 2 million euros. And he also paid for his children to go to Hill House school in London. So the fees for Hill House can be seen coming out of one of the largest companies in the laundromat. So perhaps we should say at this point, there's no evidence that Vardanian is paying for these things with the proceeds of any crime at all. And in fact, there's no suggestion he did anything illegal. But what we can clearly see is that the funds flowing in to the shell company used by Vardanian, if you track them back several steps, you get to a series of shell companies outside of the Troika network pumping money into the Troika network. And those shell companies outside have been named by prosecutors as having laundered the proceeds of major frauds in Russia.
And exclusive private school fees, they seem to be quite a popular way of spending money through the laundromat, don't they? Are there other examples in the leaks that you've seen?
There are many. So, for example, one of the big laundromat companies was paying all sorts of school fees. We've seen Lancing College there and also Oundle School. They're both big private schools in the UK, big, well-known, established private schools. But we're also seeing transfers from shell companies outside of the Troika network. For example, another shell company sent £300,000 to Charterhouse School, 5 years' worth of school fees up front.
Charterhouse is obviously a very prestigious, big private school.
A very prestigious, big private school. Jeremy Hunt, the foreign secretary, was head boy there. Ralph Vaughan Williams actually went to the school too, and he even named a piece of music that he composed in memory of his time there. It describes itself as England's most historic school, probably rightly so. But, this money came from a shell company for a kid from Russia. I don't know how many questions were asked about its origin.
How have they responded to the fact that this money's coming from?
They haven't given us any details about the checks that they carried out. What they say is that they do take these issues really seriously now, but it was a different climate then.
Mm. They're very expensive schools, so they must be getting quite big transactions from a lot of people all the time. Do they have a process to check where money's coming from?
It's a really good question. So, in fact, the Independent Schools Bursars Association has been in touch because I think they're trying to tighten their guidelines. And one of the things I've suggested to them is if you're accepting money from a company registered in a tax haven that appears to have no presence in the real world of business, ask more questions.
So, Juliet, one of the more curious things you found in these leaks relates to Prince Charles and to a country estate called Dumfries House in Scotland. Dumfries was at risk of being sold to a private buyer. So Prince Charles stepped in and he bought it through his charity in order to restore it. Why would he do that?
He loves architecture. Dumfries House is a real gem. It contains a collection of some of it specially commissioned Chippendale furniture.
This is the sort of essence of Dumfries, really.
Yeah.
This cabinet, Chippendale at his best.
And it is a very special piece and very unusual.
And the house itself is really beautiful. Dumfries House was bought in 2007 and it was a lot of money. It was £45 million. There were a lot of fears that the prince had overpaid at the time and that he'd also created black holes in the balance sheet of his charities to do it. He'd had to borrow £20 million to fund it.
Fear of failure. Do you entertain it?
Oh, yes, of course. But I mean, well, maybe I would have done better to do nothing. Nobody would have criticised, would they? But you've got to get stuck in and try to make a difference. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But it is, you know, it can be slightly more exposed in my position. As I was saying, live dangerously.
So Prince Charles has got to raise a lot of money for Dumfries House, so he goes on a fundraising drive. And one person who steps in is Reuben Vardanyan.
He does, and he starts making payments. We've got the first one in 2009, one the year after that, and the last one in 2011, and it all adds up to about $200,000. After these initial payments came through the laundromat, more money started flowing in from Vardanyan. This money doesn't come through the Troika companies or from UKIO because by this stage, Vardanyan has sold Troika and he's become very wealthy. And he started spending his money on charities. And one of them is a UK charity that he set up. In 2013, he gets together a group of other Russian donors and they give a combined £1.5 million for the restoration of a whole outbuilding at Dumfries House. Now, this building is going to make money to help pay for the running of the stately home. It's going to have 16 luxury lodges where you and I can come and stay.
Obviously, can't wait.
That's my next holiday.
So a lot of this money looks pretty above board, but the initial $200,000 is a bit strange. It came from a shell company which was part of this Troika laundromat that was registered in the British Virgin Islands. And as you've said, a lot of money passes through this network. Some of it is from crime, some of it not.
I find it really strange because why didn't the money come from Ruben Vardanian's account in his own name at wherever, Coutts Bank in London or Bank of Russia in Moscow? Wouldn't you be a bit flummoxed if someone told you they were donating and then the money arrives from a shell company in the BVI? I mean, I know that 8 years ago, people weren't as suspicious about money coming from Russia, but perhaps they should have asked a few more questions.
So one of the names that appears in these documents and that people might remember from your coverage of the Panama Papers is Sergei Roldugin. Who is he? And is it significant that he's here again?
Sergei Roldugin is a cellist. He's a modest living musician. He's also godfather to Vladimir Putin's eldest child, and he's his friend.
Is he a good cellist then?
Well, he must be very good because he's very rich from all his music playing. Because what the Panama Papers showed was that he owns companies that receive tens of millions. And what many people believe is that the offshore companies that he was apparently benefiting from, really, the assets inside those belong to the Russian president. What we see in the Troika laundromat is there's those companies supposedly owned by Roldugin received about $70 million of payments from Troika-managed companies.
So a lot of money then that he's looking after.
$70 million is a lot of money for a cellist.
Yeah. Okay, so are we saying then that British institutions like the royal family and several high-profile English private schools have accepted money through shell companies that are associated with a network that's linked to huge fraud cases in Russia, even if they can't know this and the specific money they are receiving might not be traceable to criminal funds? Shouldn't people be doing just better due diligence than this?
Yes, and I'm not the only one who thinks so. The National Security Minister, Ben Wallace, actually came out last autumn and said that's a priority. We don't just want banks to check the money that's coming in. We really need the facilitators, the lawyers and the accountants to do it. And we need the service providers to do it. So estate agents, auctioneers, people selling fine art, people selling luxury cars, even luxury handbags.
Without sounding too pessimistic, how much actual appetite is there to stop money coming into the UK, whose source we can't trace and which might be from crime?
I spoke to Bill Browder, the anti-corruption campaigner, and he said the City of London is afloat on a sea of dirty Russian money, and that's why there's no appetite to turn off the tap.
How much truth do you think there is in that?
I think that's always been London's role, hasn't it? It's a financial centre.
You think there's truth in that it's just floating on dirty Russian money?
I think there's all sorts of money. There's lots of dirty money from Nigeria. There's dirty money from Azerbaijan. Yeah, that's why, house prices went through the roof in Kensington and Chelsea. London is a safe place to stash dirty cash.
Where does the responsibility lie? Like, where should we be trying to stop this happening?
The National Crime Agency are trying, and they've brought a couple of successful cases so far, but they need political backing. I think they have it from some parts of the government, but I do not think Theresa May wants to chase Russian money out of the UK. I've seen absolutely no sign of her desire to do this. In fact, I've seen her block measures by other ministers.
So what's going to come of this investigation?
It'd be nice if someone paid some of this back, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Or, you know, if the National Crime Agency came along with some unexplained wealth orders and seized some of the properties that were bought with this money. Why should we care, right? We all benefit. It's a victimless crime. Well, it's not victimless, is it? Because we can see Russian taxpayers are the victims. But I think in the end also, It allows the Russian state to continue operating in the corrupt way that it does, and that actually presents a national security threat. If you turn off the taps, you might limit Putin's power, but if you leave them running, what you end up with is a regime that's causing trouble. They've annexed Crimea, and that came home to the UK exactly a year ago this week with the Russian-orchestrated deadly nerve agent attack in the streets of Salisbury.
Juliet, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In response to the claim that staff at an independent arm of Troika apparently helped organise the transfer of $70 million to one of Putin's best friends, Sergei Roldulgin, Ruben Vardanyan said, "I haven't done any business with him personally. Why did he receive money from Troika dialogue companies? I don't know anything about that." Sergei Roldulgin has said his wealth was merely a series of donations from rich businessmen in order to purchase expensive musical instruments for young Russians. And Vladimir Putin has said almost all the money Roldulgin earned was on acquiring musical instruments from abroad and bringing them to Russia. Explaining why the money for Dumfries House was paid via Qantas, one of the companies in the laundromat, Ruben Vardanyan said he did instruct his office to transfer funds to the Prince of Wales Charity Fund, but says his office was in charge of the details. A Clarence House spokesman said the Prince of Wales's charities operate independently of the Prince himself in relation to all decisions around fundraising. The Prince's charities said they apply robust due diligence processes and that the donations in question had raised no red flags when checks were being made. You can read more about the Troika laundromat and all of Juliet Garside's work at theguardian.com. Next, remembering the man behind Firestarter, the music video banned from the BBC. Keith Flint from The Prodigy was one of the most iconic figures of British music in the 1990s. Following his death this weekend, The Guardian's music editor Ben Beaumont Thomas has been reflecting on what Keith meant to British pop culture.
Very few frontmen of British groups have had such an arresting image, this sort of black eyeliner, the spiked hair, the kind of mad staring eyes. These things were all tropes that were sort of slightly coined in the punk era, but I think that they were just sort of dialed up to a level of intensity by Flint that we really hadn't seen before, and took The Prodigy from being a really exciting dance group into a kind of fully fledged pop and sort of rock and roll group that can speak to a huge number of people. So Firestarter reached number one, and I can really clearly remember this happening, and Mark Goodyear, the presenter at Top of the Pops, said something like, "If your parents have just left the room, you might want to get them back in here for this." Because then they didn't air a live performance of The Prodigy, they played the music video, which features Keith Flint in a kind of iconic Stars and Stripes sort of outfit, looking like he's just escaped from some kind of medium secure facility, dancing around an underground sort of cavern, gurning at the camera, hollering these lyrics about self-laceration and destruction straight to the camera, and sort of beating himself around the head. And it was an extremely arresting video. I must have been about 12 at the time, and, you know, I hadn't come across anything like this. My sister was telling me actually yesterday that she was scared stiff by this video, and it turned out that actually this video terrified a great number of children across the UK, and there were a number of complaints to the BBC, and the BBC actually banned that video. What made Firestarter and Breathe and Fat of the Land so powerful is that they came out at a time when Britpop was starting to sour. And, you know, as guitar music goes into this rather beige zone, the Prodigy help usher in this age of people like them and the Chemical Brothers and Daft Punk. I think that the way that culture has changed is feeding into the way that people are thinking about Keith. We're not in a world anymore where a video would be banned on Top of the Pops. Top of the Pops no longer exists. We no longer sit down as a nation around a small number of pop cultural media. We listen to music either on vinyl and CD for generally towards an older demographic, and on streaming for a younger demographic. And these worlds can be quite divorced, and people often create a sort of cherry-picked version of their own pop music now. I think that Keith Flint, in some ways, is one of the last people from that pre-internet era who the whole nation rallied around, and the whole nation was startled by all at once, all at the same time, at Friday night on Top of the Pops. So he was able to become a sort of cultural icon off the back of that sort of unified cultural conversation in the UK. But I think, I don't want to play that up too much. I think the key thing is that he's unforgettably, indelibly a rock star. Pay close attention. Pay close attention.
That's all for today. My thanks to Juliet Garside and Ben Beaumont-Thomas. Today's programme was produced by Joshua Kelly and Amy Walker. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We will be back tomorrow.